Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Chef Lydia Bastianich shares what comfort food she craves when the temperatures drop.
First, there are a lot of divisions in the United States along the lines of wealth, political belief, race, and religion, to name a few. And on a more basic level, we may be more isolated from one another with fewer opportunities to interact in person with other people in our communities.
Our next guest says we can change things for the better by improving what he calls the social infrastructure. That includes things like libraries and parks and even the way we design our buildings and our neighborhoods.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. His new book is Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, when we say infrastructure, we might think of water supplies, highways, railroads, that kind of thing. What do we mean by social infrastructure?
It's a different concept, so it's worth just getting it out there as we start our conversation. I define social infrastructure as the physical places and the organizations, places like YMCAs or churches, that shape our interactions. And the social infrastructure, though we haven't really had a name for it, is just as real as all of those other infrastructure systems you described. We know about it, too, because when it's working well, when we take care and invest in social infrastructure, we're much more likely to interact with one another, whether it's a planned occasion or a serendipitous encounter that we have with someone we haven't met. And through those interactions, we're more likely to build communities and even to bridge divisions. But when we neglect the social infrastructure, we become far more likely to hunker down and be on our own. Things start to fall apart then. And unfortunately, I think that's the situation we're in now.
And you've written, the first time I heard your name was, I think I booked you to come on our show to talk about the heat wave in Chicago. This is back in the 90s.
And back when we were young, Rob.
Right, exactly. And this is a case where because of a lack of social infrastructure, you wrote, a lot of people were isolated. A lot of people died, in effect, because they didn't have this social infrastructure in place in particular neighborhoods in a place like Chicago.
That's right. It's not a luxury. Social infrastructure can be a matter of life or death. And I discovered that when I was doing research for the Heatwave book. I found these neighborhoods in Chicago that looked identical demographically. The number of poor people and old people and people who lived alone was identical from a bunch of paired neighborhoods I put together. And what differed was the death rate. One place would have a death rate that was 10 times the other. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what was driving those differences. That the numbers that social scientists usually plug in to figure that stuff out just didn't tell us anything. But what I discovered in the end was it was social infrastructure that mattered. The neighborhoods that had viable sidewalks and active commercial districts, that had churches and neighborhood libraries, those places drew people out into public life and they could support one another. But the neighborhoods that had a lot of empty lots and abandoned buildings, that didn't have a lot of stores and diners and coffee shops, that had broken sidewalks, they made it much more likely that people would wind up home and alone. And in the heat wave, that meant they were far more likely to die. But the amazing thing I discovered, probably after we talked, is that it wasn't just the heat wave that mattered. It turns out that if you live in a neighborhood with a robust social infrastructure in Chicago, you're likely to live far longer, up to 5 years, than if you live in a neighborhood where the social infrastructure has fallen apart. And that's even if everything else is equal. So it's a very powerful force in our lives.
I see sometimes people talk about growing isolation in the United States as kind of a natural process. Well, technology, things have evolved along a certain path. And I think, if I'm reading you right, a key message of your book is there are a lot of choices that have been made and that we could make now that determine whether or not we have these flourishing social infrastructures.
Very much so. And, you know, I had this amazing experience because I live in New York City now, even though I grew up in Chicago and spent a lot of my life in the Midwest. But after Hurricane Sandy hit New York, I was asked by the Obama administration to be the research director for a competition called Rebuild by Design, where we worked with these amazing teams of engineers and architects and landscape architects to come up with 21st century infrastructure projects that could withstand the kinds of threats that, well, for instance, that we saw with Hurricane Florence. And when I was working with one of the design teams, they came to me and said, you know, we want to build a resilience center. We have an idea for a place that will be open much of the time, that will have programming for old people and young people and middle-aged people, that will be welcoming, open doors for everyone. And I said, you know, that's a great idea, but it sounds to me like what you're describing is a branch library. And these are places that we could build, or that if we have, that we could do a better job taking care of.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg, author of the new book, Palaces for the People, How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Let's stay in the library for a minute, Eric. I should disclose, I'm married to a librarian, so that's out there. But talk, you're a big fan of libraries and the role they play in a community. Expand on that a little.
You are. You're probably going to get a very nice dinner when you come home tonight, if we play this one right.
I do most of the cooking.
So I think libraries are a tremendous and largely underappreciated resource in American life. And there is this sentiment that you hear often these days that because we have the internet, you know, because we have Google and we carry machines with us wherever we go in our pockets, we just don't need libraries as much. They've become obsolete institutions. In fact, over the summer, Forbes magazine published an article saying we should knock down our public libraries and replace them with Amazon shops. So, you know, libraries have a kind of a bad rap. But when I was taking these design teams after Sandy around the region, I started to look into libraries to see just how they were operating as resilience centers. And I have to say, during a time in which it can feel very dark and scary to be in the United States, I mean, who knows what's going to happen here next, walking into a neighborhood library became a source of inspiration for me. I saw all kinds of activities at all hours of the day, including older people who live alone and are at risk of getting isolated, you know, coming together for virtual bowling leagues in the basements of Brooklyn libraries. That's a program they have there. I saw immigrants coming to study English as a second language or take citizenship classes. I saw young people getting exposed to early literacy programs and kids learning different languages. I saw teenagers coming in after school to do homework. I saw a remarkable range of activities that, for me, illustrate the best of what our country is. And I came to realize that libraries are doing so much more than their critics understand, and really, far from being obsolete, they are the paradigmatic social infrastructure these days. They are places where amazing things still happen, and we neglect them at our peril.
And you write that one fundamental thing about a library is it's a place that isn't your house that you can go spend time in, where you don't have to pay, you know, you don't have to buy a coffee or something to have the right to sit there for more than half an hour or so.
I mean, how many places can you think of that open the doors and ask you what they can give you and not what they can take from you? It's such a strange thing if you step back and think about it. We have inherited this idea that everyone is entitled to access, to free access to our shared cultural heritage, and that we should have it in a safe and comfortable place that's going to be open all of the time and probably close to us. This idea of the library, in some ways, it does seem antiquated, because if we didn't have the invention of a library right now, in this moment we live in where everything is based on market value and we think about costs and benefits in this very simplistic way, and we love technology, we love profit seeking, I can't imagine that we would be capable of inventing the library if it didn't already exist. And so I think it's our job, our responsibility, to protect it and to invest in it, and frankly, to update it for the 21st century. Because in addition to those things that I described about the library, it also has become a place of last resort for so many people who slip through the safety net, which now has these gaping holes in it. So I saw lots of homeless people use libraries because it's a warm place and it has a bathroom. I saw people with mental illnesses go to the library because it felt stable and comfortable. I saw people suffering from opioid addiction go to the library because they were counseled to go there by their counselors or by the places where they were getting treatment. And I saw all variety of problems that show up in the library because no one else is paying attention. So if we really want to renew libraries and make them work for 21st century needs, we're going to have to not just grudgingly give them a little bit of a budget to buy new books and fix up the upholstery. We're going to have to think about what it means to reinvent them as vital social infrastructure.
We're talking to Eric Kleinenberg right now. He's a professor of sociology at New York University. His latest book is called Palaces for the People. He says public spaces like childcare centers and libraries can help reduce polarization and inequality.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think of his argument? Do you utilize community centers, libraries, and other gathering places? What have you gotten out of the time you've spent there? And what role do you think these places should play in your community? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the importance of public spaces like libraries in fostering community. Our guest is Eric Kleinenberg. He's a professor of sociology at New York University and the author of Palaces for the People, where he makes the case that community spaces can help ease polarization.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think would help ease polarization and inequality? If you use community centers, have you found that you feel more connected with your neighbors? If you work in a place that brings different kinds of people together, tell us about it. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Go to your calls now. Anita is with us in Lindenhurst, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Hi. I wanted to just tell you how much I love our library. The Lake Villa District Library in Lake Villa, Illinois. And I have to tell you, I remember when they were a storefront 40 years ago. So what they're doing is fantastic. I don't know if all of the libraries do this, but people don't even realize what a center they are. If you need to find help, if you need to find an organization, an association, a church, whatever, they keep lists and they will help you find those things. But one of the things that is just astounding now is there's a national movement sponsored by the Foreign Policy Association. And they provide workbooks, which the library has to buy. And the number of people sign up for these once-a-month discussion groups on foreign policy, they can do their own research, but there is a book there, and we do a chapter a month. This is a group of people of varying ages, ethnicities, and believe me, differing political views.
Anita, thanks a lot. I want to jump in there and focus on that last point she made, Eric, because libraries or otherwise, you are worried, and many people are worried, that people of different backgrounds and opinions, as Anita was saying, aren't getting together and talking, and you're hoping that we can revive that.
Yeah, and Anita, I think, gave a beautiful demonstration of all the things that a library can do and things that libraries are doing. We know that too many of us live in an ideological bubble, and we know that we've become more segregated by social class than we have been in quite some time. It can be very difficult when we don't have actual interactions with one another face-to-face to generate civil conversation about the things we disagree on. And if Facebook and Twitter are our primary form of interaction, we will very quickly shout at each other in the most pointless and self-destructive ways. But if you can bring together a group of people who share an interest in ideas in a place like a library or a coffee shop or a playground even, when people are really there to take care of their kids, we get to know each other as people first, and we're then able to enter into a much more humane conversation about the things we value. It's not that we're going to solve the problem of our disagreements, but I think we're able to engage in some civil discourse that gives us a chance of having common purpose. And it's hard not to look at the country as a whole these days and feel that sense of common purpose is really at risk.
Anita, thanks for that call. I want Eric to look at another piece of social infrastructure, but this one, the way you write about it, it's a negative social infrastructure, and that's abandoned buildings. And your chapter on this part of it was excerpted, I saw. Can you talk about abandoned buildings and how they hurt social infrastructure?
Yeah, and I thought a lot about abandoned buildings, having grown up in Chicago in the 1970s and 80s, and I have family in Milwaukee and spent a lot of time there as well, and there's a similar set of issues. Abandoned buildings and empty lots in poor neighborhoods, we now know, aren't just blights. They are also generators of crime. They make it attractive for criminals to use those neighborhoods because they provide a place to hide out or to drop drugs or to find cover. And so there's this group of social scientists and epidemiologists in Pennsylvania who decided to really test this in Philadelphia, where there's more than 40,000 empty lots and abandoned homes. And they did an experiment where, working with the city and a big horticultural society, they randomly selected a set of blocks where they would fix up the empty lots and turn them into simple pocket parks that were well-maintained with wood post fences and occasionally little benches. And they'd also board up the houses. And they found that, compared to the places that they did not fix up, these treated places generated reductions in gun crime of more than 35%. And what's incredible is that reduction continues to last more than a decade, and the crime didn't just get displaced to other areas. It turns out that crimes come not simply from people who are disposed to commit crime, but also from situations. A lot of our criminal activity is situational. If someone thinks they can get away with something at a moment, they will. But if you change the situation, which you can do by fixing up the social infrastructure, you can actually generate durable reductions in crime. And so I think this is a remarkably fascinating and important finding. There are now cities around the country that are trying to replicate what's happening in Philadelphia. And if it turns out that this is really a pattern, it means we have a tool for reducing crime that is not so punitive, that will not result in widespread discrimination or mass incarceration. And it has the added benefit of not only reducing crime, but also when you fix up depleted places, you also make the quality of everyday life better.
Talking to Eric Kleinenberg, his new book is Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and Decline of Civic Life. Let's go to another caller. Gloria is with us in Platteville. Gloria, hi.
Hi, yeah. Thank you for taking my call, and I really like this topic. It's great. I have a question about...
Oop, Gloria, you're breaking up. A note from a producer says Gloria is wondering how to get teenagers and children to want to go to the library and make it more appealing. So taking this part of the social infrastructure, Eric, to the next generation.
Well, to be honest, that's not a problem at the national level in the general population. If you go to a branch library at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in almost any community in this country, you will see students rushing in the doors, and younger people are rushing in the mornings with their caretakers, in part because libraries offer all variety of services. There are books for people who want to read books, but a lot of kids are going to libraries because they can get internet access. They're using computers. They're learning computer skills. Some are playing video games. But generally what I observed when I was in New York libraries is that kids were using the video games together in a social way that seems strange to someone of my generation, but seems very natural to them. There are all kinds of programs that libraries host that welcome children and treat them as autonomous, independent, creative people. And in fact, one of the most amazing things I heard from so many people, both young and old, is that their early experiences in libraries, getting their own library card, that's their first card. Sometimes it's the first ID that you get. It gives you this license to make your own choices and take your own responsibility, right? A library book is one of the first things you learn that you have to take care of because it doesn't belong to you. And if you destroy it or don't return it, other people will suffer. It's a great civic lesson. So I will confess that as a father myself, there are days when my kids don't want to go to the library because it seems more fun to go play soccer and basketball. But over time, in the course of things, the library offers a lot of great resources and services, and kids like them too.
Thanks for the call, Gloria. Eric, in our last minute or so, supposing a civic leader, elected official or active citizen, whatever, is listening and says, yeah, I want to boost social infrastructure in my community. Give us a 1 minute first step.
Well, the first thing I would say is look at the places that you already have that could be doing more, whether that's a library or a park that's got an athletic field or a playground that hasn't been updated. There's so many resources that are at our disposal that we could improve if we just invested in them. And the other thing I would say is a lot of cities and small towns have old abandoned infrastructure that once served a purpose and that aren't getting used that much. So think about rail lines that in so many communities have been transformed into bike paths these days and trails, rails to trails programs, or open areas that once had a commercial district that start to fall apart that are renovated for open marketplaces. I think our local leaders and all of us as citizens could be more mindful about how to make places come to life and serve as social infrastructure. It's not necessarily massively expensive, but it's certainly one of the things that we're going to have to invest in when we rebuild our infrastructure, as we have no choice but to do in coming years.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Really been my pleasure. Thank you.
Eric Kleinenberg is a professor of sociology and the director of the Institute for Public Knowledge at New York University. His latest book is Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. He joined us to talk about why investing in public spaces can help people create social bonds and potentially ease polarization and inequality.
Coming up after the news, Lydia Bastianich is a well-respected chef and a public TV favorite. She joins us to talk about how to overcome challenges in the kitchen. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stay with us on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin Life is launching a new website devoted to the food traditions in our state. We'll get the details.
Right now, cooking a new type of meal can feel really rewarding when it goes right. Getting up the courage to try something new in the kitchen and dealing with mistakes along the way can be a different story.
Even for the best of us, certain things can still be intimidating, and it can be hard to push past our hesitation.
Lydia Bastianich is a chef, public television host, and author. Her latest book is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Lydia, welcome back to Central Time.
Buongiorno, Rob.
Well, thank you so much for coming over to the studio today. Now, you've been at this for a while. You've been cooking for a long time.
Yes, I've been cooking for 47 years, and I've been on public television for 20 years.
Right. Is it still possible for you to find something new, a new challenge or a new wrinkle in the kitchen?
All the time, Rob. That's the excitement, you know, in being, I think in any business, if you cannot be challenged by something new and continue to grow and then ultimately share it, then I think, you know, it sort of fizzles off. So, you know, what are my challenges? Certainly, I love the seasons, and there's always something new with the season. And, you know, you were talking about cooking, and I would recommend to stick with the seasons. The products of the seasons are at their best, usually most economical, and yield a good meal.
Winter squash, very seasonal right now. And actually, one of my colleagues made one of your winter squash recipes, this amazing thing with, I think it was cider vinegar. What are some of your favorite ways to use winter squash this kind of time of year?
It's endless. You know, winter squash, and of course, there's many different, I think also out there in the kitchen, don't just say with the butternut squash, but there's so many, the acorn, there's so many different squashes. They all are a little bit unique. You know, they're the same, that nice pulpy, orangey, yellowy kind of texture and deliciousness, but they do have, some are more nutty, some of that. And so from soups, from appetizers, you know, whether you roast it, you grill it, you're marinated in a vinegar kind of a marinade, and then you grill it, to soups, making pasta. I love making, you know, part of the pasta dish. You know, everybody's concerned about eating a lot of carbohydrates. Well, add more vegetables, more proteins in it, more squash. Squash and shrimps go fantastically well, you know, so making a nice sauce for pasta. Then, of course, as a side dish for a main course, roasted squash, squash puree, it's just endless, even dessert.
Now, there are a lot of things I will cook and I'm happy to cook in the world. And then I think I'm probably like a lot of home cooks. There's some things that scare me that I'm going to waste the money on this and I'm going to get it all wrong and it's going to be terrible. Give us a pep talk for taking on those challenges.
Well,
at home.
Rob, if you begin with, I'm going to do it all wrong, then you're going the wrong path. You got to do, you know what? I'm going to be challenged by this. And of course, I think you do some diligent research, you know, look up, read a little bit on the subject. Let's say that you want to cook calamari and you're not used to cooking calamari. Well, read up on it. You know, calamari, you need to know how to clean it, which is somewhat of a challenge, but they sell now beautiful calamari, clean, frozen, fresh frozen, and it's perfectly fine. And then you begin on cooking. You know, what's very important, especially with fish, is temperature. Do I cook it a lot? Do I cook it little? Do I undercook it? So the calamari is you either cook it quick and fast or you cook it very long to get the sauce. So, you know, once you're kind of have those guidelines, you just go and do it. And you know what, Rob? Doesn't always come the best the first time. You have to try it over and over again.
It's funny you went to seafood and fish because that's exactly what I was thinking about with intimidating and I'm going to get it wrong.
I imagine, you know, that kind of, you know, fish, octopus and calamari, people are kind of curious about them because they are, you know, out there. This is the food of the day. But yet to cook it at home, they have a little difficulties.
Now, you're famous, of course, for Italian cooking. How do you approach maybe other types of cuisines and look for elements that you can bring in and add to your own palate?
Well, you know, I am kind of wedded to the Italian culinary tradition. And that is because I came to the United States as an immigrant at 12, was born in Italy, so very much Italian, still at home, you know, with my mother, who's 98, still alive. And we speak Italian, we speak the dialect. So, but then being 12 and coming to America, I adopted America. You know, I'm an American. And so how do you, you know, communicate? And my gift has been, I guess, to communicate through food. I bring my native culture of food, the Italian, into the American. So therefore, I try to respect as much as possible what's truly happening in Italy so that I communicate that in my books, on my show, in my restaurant. But I can't say that, you know, I don't experiment, you know, ginger, lemongrass, do I put these in the Italians? I don't put them in my restaurants or in the books, but I do play with them at home.
Talking to Chef Lydia Bastianich. Her latest book, one of many, is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food. Last time you were on with us, we talked about My American Dream. Now you're going around the country talking to people about it. Are you hearing a lot of people maybe where this story really hits home with them, they've had similar experiences?
It does. It does, because it's my story, the real Lydia immigrant story. So I am an immigrant. And now,
and you're a refugee at one point.
Refugee. Well, let me just kind of summarize that. I come from a part of Italy, northeast of Venice, that was Italian. After World War II, Italy lost the war, and that part, Istria, the peninsula, was given to the newly formed communist Yugoslavia, and we were caught behind communism. Ultimately, it was difficult. We couldn't speak the Italian. We couldn't practice our religion. My parents decided that, you know, we needed to get out of there, escape back into Italy. And when we were back into Italy, you know, it was difficult of settling. We actually spent 2 years in a political refugee camp and ultimately were brought here by the Catholic Relief Services. And at that time, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and he opened immigration for people fleeing communism. That's how we came. And that's the story. But beyond that, you know, the book is, I think, you know, growing up as a young girl and with grandma, and grandma had all the courtyard animals, and where my passion for food really came, where was it born? And it was actually in those formative years with grandma, on the farm with the animals, milking the goats, picking the potatoes and all of that, that my passion for food was started.
And when you talk about food and when you write about food, it's never just food. It's family, it's culture, it's traditions. That you don't cook without those things.
Well, food doesn't stand alone. You know, food needs a table and needs people around that table to appreciate it and enjoy it. Food nurtures us, keeps us alive. And it's a way of telling somebody, you know, I mean, for me, it's great pleasure cooking. I feel I nurture people. I you know, I make them happy. I give them an opportunity to communicate at the table. It makes me very happy to see people enjoy the food.
Now, you've changed my cooking. I think the first time I talked to you, you talked about saving the scraps and freezing the bread in the freezer and the water from the pasta. I do that. At this point, my wife has stopped making fun of me for having freezers full of these scraps. Any other tips like that? Any other things you like to save? Don't waste it. Use in another way.
You know, Rob, I think that common sense is sometimes overlooked. And people just say, oh, I can't cook. I can't do that. But I think in the kitchen, really think, focus on common sense. And, you know, what is it? Are you peeling the carrot? Let's say you want a carrot, you washed it. Are you peeling the peels? Could you throw it away? Well, if you wash them, they're good. You freeze them with that, with the celery leaves and whatever. Next time you make soup, you pull it all out, you put it in the pot with the chicken bones, and you got yourself a great soup.
All right, I will, and I'm guilty. I throw away, I compost, at least I compost my carrot peels.
Good.
But I'll start using those too, again. Now, this is fall. It's comfort food season, especially coming into winter. What is Lydia's comfort food? What do you eat when you need that warm, sustaining, nourishing thing?
Well, I love pasta, but soups also. And this is a soup time. And so now it's mushroom, a nice mushroom soup with barley. And you know what I put in there? Some chestnuts too. Very much in season.
Chestnuts.
Chestnuts with mushroom and barley. Fantastic. And, you know, you sort of kind of, it really is mellow. It caresses you as you eat it. And that's a great thing that you can make a big pot. And then you freeze it, and then, you know, it sort of keeps on giving.
I've never cooked with chestnuts. Do you roast them first, or how do they go into the soup?
Well, yes. You need to either roast them or boil them, and then you peel them. And then you need to kind of cut them up because they sort of mellow into the soup, and they remain like little pieces, like beans.
Mushrooms, barley, and chestnut soup. That does sound comforting this time of year.
There you go.
Lydia, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Grazie.
Lydia Bastianich is a chef, public television host, and author. Her latest book is My American Dream, A Life of Love, Family, and Food.
Coming up, as we just heard, food is a huge part of culture. And we'll learn about a new project from Wisconsin Life that celebrates those traditions.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the biggest state news stories of the week.
Now, Wisconsin Life tells stories on both WPR and Wisconsin Public Television that highlight what makes living in our state so special.
Not surprisingly, a lot of traditions, customs, and cultures include an element of food. So Wisconsin Life has just launched a new website at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions.
Kelly Saran is a producer for Wisconsin Life on Wisconsin Public TV. Kelly, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Maureen, good to have you back.
Thank you.
So where did the idea for the Food Traditions Project come from, Kelly?
Well, it actually came from one of our staff members. The idea was to kind of explore food in Wisconsin. We've been exploring food in Wisconsin Life for a long time, but never in an in-depth way that we could really come into people's homes. They could cook with us and share their recipes. So we love this idea, and we really wanted a chance to kind of bring the community into the storytelling of food. And of course, radio's also been doing a lot of food stories over the years as well.
Yeah, I think telling stories about food is a really easy way for us to connect with one another. All humans, most humans, have to eat food to survive, mm-hmm. but we eat food in such different ways. And maybe you don't know a lot about the Hmong culture or the Scandinavian culture, but if you can hear about their stories through food, it's a really easy way and a really fun way to get to know other cultures that are different from your own.
So it sounds like at least one of the goals is to help people appreciate and understand the cultures and the food that other people enjoy.
Yeah, and definitely. And we've met so many people around the state that I never tasted this food before. I never had an experience with it. Even lutefisk, I've never lived in the state my whole life. Whoa, never tried that till this time. But it is a chance. It is like kind of the foot in the door into communities a lot of the time. People can kind of gather around food always.
Well, Maureen, you did a segment on that most Scandinavian of dishes, lutefisk. Here's a little bit of that.
They asked me how I found the lutefisk. I said there was a truck went by and we just followed our nose. My name is Dale and last name is Erlinson, and I live in Antigo. My nickname is Swede. That might have something to do with the fact that I like lutefisk. Well, mostly because it's a good fish. Because they cook the lutefisk just perfect.
Our patriarchs here have been eating lutefisk since they could crawl, and it wasn't our favorite as children, but it's really grown on us, and now it's a great tradition.
It sounds like you talked to some fun people for that one.
The lutefisk dinner was amazing. My in-laws are Norwegian, so I had heard about lutefisk for many, many years and the lore surrounding it. And so to actually be in this church basement with people eating lutefisk, preparing lutefisk, I mean, that the Swede, the man who we just heard, he traveled from Anago. He traveled like 3-4 hours for this lutefisk dinner because he loves lutefisk so much. It was absolutely incredible. And just seeing how that community comes together over this, what some would say, a very controversial dish. But they love it. And it's a way for them to, you know, reminisce on their childhoods, think back to their parents and their grandparents, and then also just celebrate their families today.
I thought it was interesting, too, because one of the guys you talked to said, you know, we weren't crazy about it as kids, but now we really love it. And I think in some ways that's really typical of how we think about our cultures and traditions. When we're kids, it's like, yeah, whatever, we do this. You know, when can I go play with my cousins? And it's as we get older and we appreciate the significance of it that it really becomes a much more a part of us.
Oh, for sure. And if you have like buckets of butter, that also helps.
That buckets of butter is always good. Well, Kelly, you produced a piece about Hmong feasts. Let's take a listen to that.
For me, cooking is like art. Instead of using ink or, you know, oil to paint on canvas. For me, cooking my pan, that's my canvas. And then my ingredients, that's my ink. When I think about food in my early childhood, food was a really big deal in the Hmong community. I just chose these recipes because they're simple, they're delicious. And in the Hmong cuisine, if you work all day when you come home, you just want a nice bowl of rice and just something delicious.
So what was that like, Kelly? What did you learn from that experience?
So I was welcomed to Lucy Lohr's kitchen, and she didn't just prepare one dish, because you can't. You can't, with the Hmong community, prepare one dish. You have to create an entire feast. So she started cooking and cooking, and it was like she was producing these beautiful dishes. And really, it tied into the idea that she learned to cook from her mother, and her parents came from Thailand in the 90s, and they had very little. So her mother started to grow her own food, started to teach her how to use certain herbs, all these different things. And she kind of learned about food through her mother. So it was almost like you could, it's kind of the in-between of both modern and traditional dishes is what I really like about Lucy's story as well. So she prepared modern dishes, but then her own twist. And I think that's a lot about what food traditions are, but kind of making these traditions into yourself and into how you want to cook and how you see it. And it turned out that actually as Lucy was kind of going through a physical change into her true identity, she used food to reconnect with her parents, to keep them coming into the door. So she would cook them a nice meal, have them come over, and they could kind of talk through some things that maybe her parents weren't comfortable with. And now they have a very close relationship, very strong. So it's almost like food traditions can mean so much more than just the food you eat. It's so much bigger. And Lucy's story really tells that.
And what was she cooking? Because my mouth is watering without even knowing the details.
She cooked boiled chicken. She had tofu peppers was really tasty as well. And that was delicious. And she kind of had this kind of beefy salad. And everything's kind of tangy and sweet. It's like hits all those taste buds right in your mouth. Ugh, just delicious.
Wow. We are talking with Kelly Saran and Maureen McCullum. They're with us to talk about the new Wisconsin Life site devoted to food traditions in Wisconsin. You can find those stories at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions. Now, Wisconsin's cultures and their food traditions are pretty varied. Were there any common themes that arose when you were working on these stories?
I would say the common theme always is togetherness in a way. When we went to the Oneida Nation and we kind of learned about white corn soup and the idea that these are two, a pair of close cousins that are actually using white corn soup and white corn in general to kind of resurrect food sovereignty in the Oneida Nation and keeping kind of the traditional seeds of the past to feed them today. So their community comes together in the husking bee every year, so they're getting together. Layla, the Kormasabsi recipe that we explored in Madison, her family meets every Sunday together at the family, and they eat this dish that her grandmother once did. So it's really a time of unitedness. You see people coming together, whether whether it's in their individual sense or together with their past, kind of touching on things that maybe, oh, wow, this reminded me of my childhood, and this is why I want to share it with you, and this is why it's important to me as well.
Yeah. Maureen, what have you found talking with people?
Yeah, well, WPR's Daniel Kading, who's our reporter based in Superior, she did this great piece with this woman named Catherine Denemy. And Catherine lives on the Bad River Reservation, and she makes fry bread, which fry bread is a staple in many Native American homes. Catherine grew up with her mother making fry bread for powwows back in like the 60s and 70s. And she's decided to carry on that tradition. She started a business where she makes the dough and sells the dough to people. And for her, it was really important to make this dish by hand. She wanted to have that connection to the flour and everything like that. So it was really important for her to make fry bread by hand for people in her community and carry on that tradition that her mother taught her.
And in the piece, too, she says, you know, a lot of old ladies know how to make this and the younger ones don't. So it's kind of that idea we're keeping things alive in communities through food.
It's almost like oral storytelling, because I'm sure a lot of these recipes are not written down with really well-defined, you know, quantities of ingredients and things like that. It's really passed along by cooking next to each other.
Oh, for sure. And I would say, you know, as you said that, I think of my own family, my in-laws, the ones who had lutefisk growing up. You know, they talk about how there's a lefse recipe that they never got from one of the members of the family who recently passed away, and how they really regret that and that they didn't take the time to learn how to make lefse. Now, one could argue that we could go and learn lefse from other members of the family, but, you know, something's kind of lost there. So I think it is really important for us to think about, you know, what are the dishes that mean so much to us and mean so much to our families, and how do we keep that going?
My mother died when I was in high school, and she was from an Italian background. And one of the things that I wish I knew how to cook was this anchovy soup that she made. And it was like a spicy tomato broth with anchovies in it, chickpeas, a little bit of pasta. And I can taste it sitting here, but it's not something that I ever learned to make. And you know, if there was one thing I could like go back in time and ask, it would be like, how do you make that anchovy soup?
Yeah. And that's the thing, is like people really connect with it. Like just like you shared your story, it's so easy to come and connect with someone around a food that they know of the past. It tastes good. It smells good. It really brings you back to that place.
Is there something from your family heritage, Kelly, that food just really brings to life?
You know, we used to do a tradition of roasting chestnuts on Thanksgiving Eve. Some people who did it with us in the past aren't there anymore. But I always, whenever I see them in the store, I look at them and I think, you know, that brings me back.
Are there more stories that you guys kind of have on the back burner that you're like, as soon as we have time, we're going to go out and cook with this person?
There are a couple ideas I have. I don't know much about the Burmese diet, and I know that there are like the highest percentage of refugees in Wisconsin are people from Burma. So I'm kind of curious, like, what are some Burmese food traditions? We have a huge Italian population in specifically southeast Wisconsin. What are some really traditional Italian dishes? Not the dishes that we maybe find in Olive Garden or whatever Italian restaurant in town. But what are some true Italian dishes? Kelly?
Yeah, and I would say we actually really want to hear from viewers and listeners as well, too. This is your opportunity to kind of get out there and share your tradition with us, and we can look at stories for next year if we continue the project as well. But
and how can they do that?
Yeah, so you can connect with us on Instagram. We actually have a hashtag food traditions WI, and that's the place that we really want you to share your stories with us. So it's hashtag food traditions WI, and we'd like you to either share recipes, and you can get recipes from the site as well too. So if you try any of our recipes, let us know. See how it went. Didn't great go well for me the first time. I'll tell you that much. I was like really missing that taste. Yeah. But yes, please connect with us. And also we're on Instagram, Facebook. So just reach out to us and share your tradition.
Well, Kelly, Maureen, thanks so much for sharing the information. It's a great series.
Thanks, Judith.
Kelly Saran and Maureen McCollum joined us to talk about the new Wisconsin Life site devoted to food traditions in Wisconsin. You can find those stories at wisconsinlife.org/foodtraditions.
Coming up after the news, Rob Menser joins us for a look at some of the top state news stories from the week. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. This is Central Time.
comic book legend Stan Lee died earlier this month at age 95. He'd been entertaining the world with his illustrations and stories for a long time.
Well, it turns out that comics as a way to tell stories goes way back. I mean, way back. Archaeologists in Jordan recently found drawings inside a 2,000-year-old tomb from Roman times, and they look quite a bit like modern comic strips.
The drawings show a variety of scenes, bustling streets in a thriving city, gods feasting on Mount Olympus, peasants tending their fields, and more.
But what was so surprising was that several dozen characters are shown with thought bubbles like we see in comics.
And just like in our comics, the captions help to explain what's going on. A couple of examples are, I am cutting stone. And my favorite, alas for me, I am dead.
Well, they're not sure whose tomb it is, but researchers think it was probably whoever was considered the founder of the town, since the story that runs through the drawings shows the life of that community.
I wonder if these hold up in translation. I know it sounds like some pretty gripping narrative.
I
want to hear more about this stone cutting story.
And I want to hear about how the guy that's, alas, I am dead, was dead.
Yeah, and how he's still telling us about it.
Well, you know, it's kind of like opera.
Wham! Pow! That's what I want to see
there
in these ancient Roman comic
strips. Well, you know, these aren't the only places. There are also even older ones in Egypt. So comics have been around for a long time.
To be continued on Central Time.